Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is prominent academic Nancy K. Miller, author of What They Saved, Pieces of a Jewish Past. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Apparently May is Jewish Heritage Month in America, something I didn't actually know until I read in the paper last week. This commemoration has been around since 2006, apparently, when it was started as a way of celebrating the 350th anniversary of American Judaism. The initiative came from the Jewish Museum of South Florida. It was proclaimed by Congress in both 2005 and 2006 and then signed into law by President George W. Bush. This time around, President Barack Obama celebrated the shared struggle of Jewish identity in proclaiming Jewish Heritage Month, issuing a proclamation last week that celebrated the perseverance of Jewish Americans in overcoming adversity and hostility in order to reach success in America. All true. Well, I think I would be more excited about this American Jewish Heritage Month if I hadn't looked up just how many National Heritage Months our U.S. Congress has already proclaimed. You probably were unaware of the fact that there are currently National Heritage Months for Irish Americans, Italian Americans, Greek Americans, Hispanic Americans, Filipino Americans, Asian Pacific Americans, Haitian Americans, Native Americans, and Caribbean Americans. For some reason, German Americans only merit a single day on the calendar, not a whole month. But since Germans are very efficient, that's probably all they need. For us Jews, who are far messier, I think a month may not prove to be enough. Anyway, that's all in addition to Black History Month and Women's History Month. In fact, when you start looking at all the commemorations and holidays proclaimed by our federal government, you begin to think that the Jewish calendar's plethora of festivals isn't really as over the top as it is. There are actually 46 special months recognized by presidential proclamation. 46 special months when there are only 12 months in a year. Only the government could manage that arithmetic, as well as 20 special weeks and 47 special days recognized by presidential proclamation. This even makes the Catholic Saints Day calendar, which has had many more centuries to develop, seem kind of reasonable. So just this month, our American Jewish Heritage Month is shared with Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, Older Americans Month, National Physical Fitness and Sports Month, National Foster Care Month, and Mental Health Awareness Month. I can certainly understand Jews sharing with Mental Health Awareness Month. After all, we invented psychology, which was once called the Jewish science, with Sigmund Freud as the principal creative force, a nice Austrian Jew. Anyway, some of my favorite special periods of national time include National Financial Literacy Month, National Cybersecurity Month, and the ever-popular National Critical Infrastructure Protection Month, all real winners in the excitement category. And who can fail to celebrate National Dairy Goat Awareness Week with all the appropriate festivities? I was distressed to learn that we no longer regularly celebrate another presidentially proclaimed holiday, National Catfish Day. Reagan proclaimed that one. In any case, May is National Jewish American Heritage Month, and since we've been around here in America for 358 years now, and in an era when people think that bagels are a purely American baked good, it's worth noting our contributions to American society are extensive and go beyond the culinary. Like the American Jewish community, I did find the presidential proclamation curiously eclectic. It highlighted the achievements of Jewish Americans like composer Aaron Copland, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, physicist Albert Einstein, and writer and art collector Gertrude Stein, stating that their achievements forever enriched our national life. No word on Monica Lewinsky. Our country is stronger for their contributions, and this month we commemorate the myriad ways they have enriched the American experience, President Obama said. All true enough. So, Go ahead and feel especially proud to be an American Jew this month of May. And, of course, find a way to celebrate by doing something actually and actively Jewish. You know, like attending a temple near you on Shabbat for services. This week would be nice. To play us in on this fine May morning, here's a piece of American Jewish history, a classic cut from a recent re-release from an upcoming guest of Two Jewish, a CD from the 1960s called Songs for the American Jewish Jet Set, I kid you not, as sung by a guy named Leo Fold, known in those days as the Jewish Fred Astaire. Well, it's fun anyway. It's about needing mazel. That is, good luck.
Ba-da-da, mazel, mazel, mazel. Bobble-da-bobble-a-ba, just a little mazel. That's the only thing you need. You gotta have a little mazel. Mazel means good luck. Cause with a little mazel, you always make a buck. And if you have no mazel, although you're on the bowl, you try and try and can't get by. You beat your head against the wall. Don't ever try to figure why you seem to be to blame. That some folks have a million and can't even write their name. That's why you gotta have a little mazel. Mazel means good luck, cause with a little mazel, you always make a buck. A Mensch muss haben Mazel, das ist doch festgestellt. Als man hat ein bisschen Mazel, gehört dir die ganze Welt. Und bist du ein Schlummazel, dann streckst du aus der Hand. Der Leuchter hin, der Leuchter her, mit dem Kopf du hackst den Mann. Man kann mich schicken werden, von klären frag ich dich. Vor Wuss hat eine Million, ein kenn ich, unterschreiben sie. Ein Mensch muss haben Mazel, das ist doch festgestellt. Als man hat ein bisschen Mazel, ist mir kein Malone Geld. Babble the bottle, bottle, bop, babble the bop, bop, bop. Oh, you gotta have a little muzzle. Muzzle means good luck, cause with a little muzzle, you always make a buck. And if you have no muzzle, although you're on the bowl, you try and try and can't get by. You beat your head against the wall. Don't ever try to figure why you seem to be to blame. That some folks have a million and can't even write their name. Rip, muzzle, muzzle, muzzle. Es ist doch festgestellt, zum Glück lach sein Habibi ist Mazel mehr wie Geld.
That was Leo Fold singing Mazel, a piece of classic American Jewish shtick. When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments during this American Jewish Heritage Month, we'll meet our guest, prominent academic Nancy K. Miller, author of the compelling book What They Saved, Pieces of a Jewish Past, and find out just how a Jewish gangster who worked for Dutch Schultz became the first mayor of South Tucson. When we return on Two Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, the great Italian philosopher Antonio Garaducci once said, "To find balance in life is to find happiness." Now, I assume he was a smart guy, being a philosopher and all. So it gets me to thinking, balance is probably a good thing when it comes to pizza, too. You know, just the right amount of sauce, cheese, crust, and toppings. But consider this. What one mama's customer might think is just the right amount of something, another customer might think is too much or too little. That's why at Mama's, we balance every item we make to each individual customer's taste. Extra cheese or light cheese? Heavy on the sauce or easy on the sauce? Crispy crust or lightly done crust? It's all in balance for each customer. And as Garaducci says, balance equals happiness, and that equals loyal Mama's customers. So I'd say that, on balance, that's a pretty good situation. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Nancy K. Miller. She's Distinguished Professor of English and Comparative Literature at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, one of the perhaps most distinguished academics in the country. She's the author and editor of more than a dozen books, in particular the book What They Saved, Pieces of a Jewish Past. Good morning.
Good morning, Sam.
So tell the story of how you got into writing the story of the Kipnis family, of your history.
Right. The story actually began with something like an accident, in the sense that although I had gathered materials from my family's past in the form of ephemera, clippings, photographs, and so on, they were so mysterious that I didn't know what to do with them, and I just put them back in a drawer. I got a phone call in the year 2000 from a real estate broker in Los Angeles, telling me that he had identified property that my grandparents, my paternal grandparents, had bought, and that he was now in a position to sell this property for a large amount of money, and the only condition was to find all the heirs. So,
boy, that's a nice phone call. Most of us would like to get.
But truthfully, it sounded very strange.
Sure, suspicious even.
Yes, even. And I really, as I say in the book, you know, I thought it was a scam. But one of the things that I had saved, and I remembered having saved, was a folder. My father had been a lawyer, and he saved everything in these long legal manila folders. And I had seen something that said property in Israel, but I, you know, it had canceled checks from 1926. I mean, I thought, well, there's nowhere to go with this. But I saved it because I believe in never throwing anything away. As my father did, and so it turned out it was true. And the only heir that was, well, I have a sister, so I didn't have to look for her, but I needed to find my father's nephew, which is to say, the son of his older brother, Sam Kipnis, whom I had never met. So that was my first step, was going to Memphis, Tennessee, where I had never been, meeting this my first cousin for the first time, and his daughter for the first time. And it was from this meeting that all the research began, because the daughter, Sarah, was already fascinated by family genealogy, and she had in fact found something I would never have dreamed of looking for, a website with the Kipnis name, with kipnis.org. And on this website, they had already posted the ship's manifest for everyone with the Kipnis name, and there I was. That was a hook, and I was hooked almost immediately once I saw there was a place to start.
And you didn't just start. It's a great story, and we'll find out where it goes, including some very unusual places, a gangster or two, the first mayor of South Tucson, when we come back with Nancy K. Miller on Two Jewish. Among my most pleasant and least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the total Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know anyone who might qualify for the 2012 Cohan Award, just visit our website, CohanAward.com. That's CohanAward.com. And you can find the nomination form there. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's CohanAward.com, CohanAward.com. It's a good visit and a great place to learn about a terrific award and all the recipients.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio@yahoo.com. That's toojewishradio@yahoo, or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Ben-Zion Netanyahu, historian, one-time political activist, and father of Israel's Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, died in Jerusalem last week at the ripe old age of 102. An accomplished scholar and the patriarch of one of Israel's most important political families, he played a surprising and little-known role in American political history, but one that had and has lasting implications. More about that in a moment. Netanyahu was born in Poland in 1910 to a family immersed in the world of religious Zionism. His father brought the family to British-ruled Palestine, the Yeshuv, in 1920. In the wake of the Palestinian-Arab murderous riots of 1929, which killed many Jews, Netanyahu was attracted to the militant wing of the Zionist movement, Revisionist Zionism, headed by Vladimir Zev Jabotinsky. His literary talent was recognized early on. He became the editor-in-chief of the revisionist newspaper Hayardain in the 1930s. In 1940, Jabotinsky sent his leading disciples, including Netanyahu and future Knesset member Hillel Cook, known as Peter Bergson, to the United States to look for funds and public support for the rescue of Europe's Jews and for the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine. "It was a brand new world for us," the senior Netanyahu said. "I'd never been to America. I had to learn quickly. There was no time. The world of European Jewry was going up in flames." Netanyahu became executive director of the U.S. wing of the revisionist Zionist movement and editor of its magazine, Zion News. One of his 1944 editorials criticized mainstream Jewish leaders as too cautious, too appeasing, too ready to swallow the meaningless statements of sympathy that are issued from high places. Bergson and Netanyahu employed tactics not commonly used then by the American Jewish community, including full-page ads in the New York Times. Some of those ads challenged the Roosevelt administration's stance on refugees. Others took aim at the British government's white paper, closing Palestine to Jewish immigration. One that Netanyahu wrote was headlined, "The White Paper Must Be Smashed If Millions of Jews Are to Be Saved." Netanyahu split his time between the revisionist headquarters in New York and Capitol Hill in Washington, where he tried to mobilize congressional backing for the Zionist cause. At the time, mainstream Jewish leaders like Rabbi Stephen S. Wise were strong supporters of FDR and stayed away from Republicans. Netanyahu, by contrast, actively cultivated ties to prominent Republicans like former President Herbert Hoover. In 1944, Netanyahu worked to have the Republican Party endorse Jewish rescue and statehood. In the months leading up to that year's Republican National Convention, the revisionist Zionists undertook what they called a systematic campaign of enlightenment about Palestine among GOP leaders like Hoover, Senator Robert Taft, who chaired the convention's Resolutions Committee, and Representative Claire Booth Luce, wife of the publisher of Time and Life. The GOP ended up adopting an unprecedented plank, demanding refuge for millions of distressed Jewish men, women, and children driven from their homes by tyranny, and the establishment of a free and democratic Jewish state. Interestingly, the Republicans' move compelled the Democrats to compete for Jewish support and treat the Jewish vote as if it were up for grabs. Roosevelt had gotten 90% of it in 1940. The Democratic National Convention, which was held in Chicago the next month, for the very first time in 1944, endorsed unrestricted Jewish immigration and colonization of Palestine and the establishment of a free and democratic Jewish commonwealth. Bencio Netanyahu helped ensure that support for Zionism and later Israel would become a permanent part of the American political culture. Every single subsequent Republican and Democratic convention has adopted a similar plank. To do less has become politically inconceivable. While doing all this, Bencio Netanyahu managed to complete a doctorate in medieval Jewish history at Dropsy College in Philadelphia, later a part of the University of Pennsylvania, where he also taught before moving on to Denver and then Cornell. He was the science editor as well for Encyclopedia Hebraica between 1944 and 2005. Kind of amazing. He married. They had three sons. The oldest, Yonatan, born in 1946, commanded the top military unit of Israel, Sayeret Matkal. He was the only Israeli killed during Operation Entebbe in the summer of 1976. By the way, the dramatic Entebbe rescue that took Yoni Netanyahu's life happened when I was in Israel for the first time. And in the euphoria surrounding that amazing rescue, Netanyahu became a heroic name. Their second son was Benjamin Binyamin, born in 1949, and currently, by the way, the Israeli prime minister. And their third son, Ido, is a physician, author, and playwright. Bencio Netanyahu's magisterial study, The Origins of the Inquisition in 15th Century Spain, was widely considered a groundbreaking work when it was published in 1995. It is still the most important book in its field. Netanyahu was known to hold political views that were even more to the right than his sons, sometimes much more, and was often publicly critical of the prime minister's policies, including his sons, from the right. Bencio Netanyahu was a seminal, controversial figure in Israel, but it is likely his impact on American politics some 68 years ago that has had the most lasting effect and helped make support for Israel perhaps the single most comprehensively bipartisan element in American political culture. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
You got a big day today.
It's a big day. We're running like crazy. We have our big Israel festival today from 1 o'clock to 6 o'clock at the JCC. We're now in all the preparations. Tables are being put into place. The art fair is being prepared. The exhibits of the community vendors, congregations, other Jewish organizations are all in place. The exhibit about Jerusalem is already ready and set up for you to come and see and learn about Jerusalem in history, ancient history, modern history. The Israel University of the festival university at the second floor, all the speakers are being ready. You can come, learn, educate yourself, hear stuff. And of course, for the kids, the crazy pool party that we're going to have at 1 o'clock. And later on with the bouncing castles, with the Zumba, with the Israeli dancing. Oh God, we have so many stuff coming up. It is going to be a blast. So I really hope to see you all. Are you coming, Rabbi?
Yes, I am. I'll bring my youth choir too and my kids and we'll have a good time.
And of course, how could I forget? We have all the choirs performing at the auditorium. And we have the second floor with the Bedouin Cafe and with Tina Bakery, Jerusalem style bakery, make and take your own stuff. And THA exhibit. And we have so many, and people are now at the J, they're running from one place to the other to prepare everything. We have a lot of volunteers and a lot of staff person. They're carrying stuff from one place to the other. The atmosphere is crazy, and at 1 o'clock, things will be ready for you. The doors will open, and that's the time to come from 1 o'clock to 6 o'clock. Take the time. There is food to purchase. You can eat here. Great food by Usher.
The L'chaim Catering.
L'chaim Catering. Right. And the J Cafe. And great opportunities for you to celebrate, to educate your kids, to have fun together. To get one of the parents to take the kids to have fun and send the other parent to go to the university and hear some stuff. It's really a great opportunity to combine Jewish education and a lot of fun. Taking out the oi, putting in the joy, and celebrating Israel.
You've got every slogan I could think of. By the way, this is the nearest thing to Israel you can get without going to Tel Aviv, and especially Jerusalem. It's at the J today, and if you want to come to Israel, we can help you do that too.
Sure thing. So come to the Israel Festival and then go and buy your tickets to fly to Israel. That's great.
Thanks, Guy.
See you today.
Take care. We'll talk next week. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We were talking last week about the tremendous level of tolerance in Israel and the diversity of the population, which is not terribly well publicized here. One thing that is well publicized here, has been over the years, is the separation fence or the border wall or whatever phrase you want to use to apply to it. What it stands for, what it's helped to do, what it hasn't done, what it stands for as a symbol. Let's talk about it a little bit.
Well, there are a lot of open questions surrounding this barrier, which is highly controversial, both inside Israel and outside Israel. Outside Israel, it causes many people, particularly in Europe and some people in this country, to label Israel as an occupier, an oppressor, an apartheid state, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of really negative phrases with horrible connotations.
Well, in Israel, you know, Europe would certainly know about building ghetto walls and things like that, wouldn't they?
Right, and they'd also know about the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall and sure. Whatever. I mean, there's all kinds of negative associations from other eras and other places. And in Israel, it's also very controversial, in part just because of how it looks. So the look is not pretty. It is a barrier. It is often ugly. And it is often ineffective to the point where, at one point, we're going in a taxi from the international airport to Jerusalem, and we passed the wall at many points and many checkpoints because we were wandering through what used to be called the West Bank. It's a slightly shorter route to Jerusalem, so the taxi driver can save some gas. Doesn't really save time because of all the checkpoints. But at one point, sitting on top of the wall, with in spite of the barbed wire and everything else around it, is a teenage boy, like an obviously Arab teenage boy who's 12 years old, who's just sitting up there waving at passing traffic. So obviously, he can get up from one side and down on the other, and you have to wonder, how effective is this horribly controversial, ugly, and embarrassing wall? On the other hand, there's an old saying, particularly loved by Anglo-Saxons and Anglo-Saxon countries, that good fences make good neighbors. We value a certain degree of separation and privacy. And a lot of Anglo-Saxons see value in walls. For me, I didn't come away with any judgment one way or another about this. I see pluses and minuses. I see Israel concerned, understandably, about its own security and ongoing terrorist attacks. It seems that the wall has reduced, at least slightly, if not significantly, the number of terrorist incidents and their severity. It has certainly limited access. In a lot of cases, Arab workers have been replaced by people from Thailand and the Philippines, and more recently, people from sub-Saharan Africa. So literally, the face of Israel is changing. The colors in Israel are changing. You go to the Tel Aviv Central bus station now, you see as many Asians and Africans as you see in New York City. It's quite amazing. Is that something to be thankful for? Not really sure, but it's a fact of life.
Thanks, Tom. We will talk much more next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Arnold, who is 29 years old and still lives at home, comes down for breakfast one morning after a great night out. As soon as he sits down, he says to his parents, "Mom, Dad, you'll be pleased to hear I met a great girl last night. I was so captivated by her beauty and charm that by the end of the night, I could see the two of us getting married under the chuppah. At last, I found someone. What do you guys think of that?" His father replies, "Well, Arnold, it sounds like something is happening for you at last, but it's important for you to marry someone who has the same belief as the family." "But Dad," says Arnold, "why would I want to marry a girl who thinks I'm a schmuck?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week. A special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Behar from the book of Leviticus, which establishes the rules for the sabbatical and jubilee years, the most important form of environmental legislation in the ancient world. Concern for the environment in Judaism has always been an important part of our tradition. The very first text about caring for the natural world goes back to Genesis, where we are commanded to be stewards of God's creation. But the most important Jewish legislation in the Torah is found in Leviticus, in the section we read this week in Parshat Behar. "You must have a sabbatical every seventh year, and the land shall rest." We're instructed to do no active planting or cultivation, to allow the fields to lie fallow, to give the earth a chance to recover. This is considered today to be good, practical agricultural policy. It allows time for nature to restore the nutrients that grains leach from the soil, allows the fallen fruit in the orchards to nourish the loam. It's a fundamental part of crop rotation in areas practicing modern farming technique. The remarkable fact about this Shemitah, this sabbatical mitzvah, is that it originated in the Torah, a document at least 2,500 years old, and which contains text that's probably 700 or 800 years older than that. That is, the scientific concern for the health of the environment goes back 3,000 years in Judaism, and the requirement to care for the natural world as responsible humans is at least as long-standing. There are many more commandments in the Torah relating to stewardship of the natural world. Even in warfare, we're prohibited from destroying our enemy's fruit trees or seriously damaging the productive capacity of the land to feed its inhabitants. This is in contrast to the ancient Roman Empire's policy of sowing salt in the fields of conquered enemies to destroy their productive capacity and to create forced starvation. Ironically, it's also in contrast to the occasional policy of the Israeli military in bulldozing the olive trees of Arab terrorist families. The injunction is clear. We are to respect the natural environment, since it is a reflection of God's holiness projected into this world. There are contemporary consequences for this most ancient commandment. The sabbatical year off of teaching, so beloved on university campuses, comes directly from this week's portion of Behar, a time to recharge batteries and renew scholarship, just as the land replenishes itself through a year of Shemitah, divine rest. A great lesson in a world in which we often seem more intent on domination than cultivation. May we learn Behar's lesson, and so allow our land to renew itself. And then we might even learn to allow ourselves some rest, and so come to replenish our own spiritual resources, like this week with Shabbat. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Nancy K. Miller, will explore what it was that tempted her to discover her family's unexpectedly Jewish history and how it changed her life. Find out when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In Israel, former opposition leader Tzipi Livni resigned from Israel's Knesset last week. Livni delivered a prepared statement announcing her departure from the legislature prior to a meeting with Knesset Speaker Reuven Rivlin. There she submitted that letter. "I shall continue to work for a different Israel. Our children deserve no less," Livni told Rivlin when she submitted the resignation. She said that although she was leaving Knesset, she was not going to absent herself from public life. In a swipe at current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, she said in her speech that she was not sorry for refusing to sell out the government to the Haredi Orthodox in order to form a government. Livni reportedly will remain in the Kadima party but will not run in the next elections as a candidate. It has been rumored that she would join the new party of former journalist Yair Lapid, who registered his Yesh Atid party, there is a future it means, last week. Livni lost the March primary to lead the Kadima party to Shaul Mofaz, a former chief of staff of the IDF. In 2009, in the general election, Tzipi Livni led the Kadima party to 28 Knesset seats, actually one more than Netanyahu's Likud, the second largest party. But Livni was unable to form a coalition, and instead Netanyahu put together a block of religious and right-wing parties that's been in power ever since. In other news, Delmon Young, the Detroit Tigers outfielder who was arrested in New York for allegedly attacking a group of men and making anti-Semitic remarks, was suspended without pay for a week. The suspension is retroactive to April 27th when he was placed on the restricted list. He'll lose about $250,000 in salary. Delmon Young will not contest the suspension. Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig announced the suspension, saying that those associated with our game should meet the responsibilities and standards that stem from our game's stature as a social institution. An incident like this cannot and will not be tolerated. I think that Mr. Young is regretful. It is my expectation he will learn from this unfortunate episode. Delmon Young is facing a misdemeanor aggravated harassment hate crime charge from the April 27th incident outside the Hilton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, where the Tigers were staying before the start of a series with the Yankees. Young is scheduled to appear in court in New York May 29th. He faces up to a year in jail if convicted. According to the reports, a group of tourists staying at the hotel were approached by a panhandler wearing a yarmulke. Young yelled anti-Semitic epithets at the group. He also reportedly shoved one of the guys who sustained minor injuries. Delmon Young was taken to the hospital himself after the incident. The New York police said that it was unclear whether the alleged victim, described as a 32-year-old male, was Jewish. Young was suspended for 50 games back in 2006 for throwing a bat at an umpire. He apologized publicly. And in happier news, Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands last week knighted Rabbi Binyamin Jacobs, making him an officer of the Order of the Orange Nassau. The head of state gave the title to the 63-year-old rabbi, who is the religious leader of the country's Jewish communities outside of Amsterdam, Rotterdam, and The Hague, in a very festive ceremony. "This is an important day for Jews in this part of the world," said Benoit Wesley, the head of the Jewish community of Limburg. "The title bestowed on Rabbi Jacobs is a great honor to all Jews in the country. It's a source of pride for us. We thank the Almighty for helping Jacobs receive such an honor." In recent years, Rabbi Jacobs, a member of the Rabbinical Council of the Rabbinical Center of Europe, has been one of the most outspoken defendants of kosher slaughter, shechita, giving interviews, taking part in debates, opposing those who would have it banned on grounds that it violated animal rights. "And now you know why this night is different from all other nights. He uses his sword to make chickens kosher, for one thing." And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Nancy K. Miller. She is one of the most distinguished academics you will have a chance to hear from, and she's also the author of What They Saved, Pieces of a Jewish Past, an autobiographical exploration of her family throughout the generations. Let's keep going, because you started by telling us earlier in the show the story of kind of what triggered this, which was basically unclaimed real estate being sold and finding pieces of your family in Memphis and where they led you.
Right. My first cousin was much older than I was, and he was quite ill, and the only thing he wanted to talk about was himself, which was a whole other narrative. But he did mention in passing, in the most casual way, that his father had worked for the Jewish gangster Dutch Schultz, who was known as the Dutchman. And I truthfully had to go back and look it up on Wikipedia when I got home, because I didn't really know very much about Dutch Schultz. But it turned out he was known to be the beer baron of the Bronx. So according to my cousin, my uncle...
This, of course, during Prohibition.
Yes, exactly. And Prohibition actually plays a funny role in this story, which, if you can remind me, we'll get. I'll make the link.
So, okay.
Anyway, so he described how my his father would ride along on a horse-drawn carriage with these, you know, kegs of beer, and he would deliver, and that was, you know, that was part of his job. The other part of his job was collecting mafia money, or whatever it's called, protection money from various businesses.
Extortion is what they call
it.
Yeah,
well, I guess that's what it might be called. And he took the money. He would take these little packets of money to the Cotton Club, which is a very famous club in Harlem.
Club, right?
And he would deliver the money there. And so that story, I was absolutely. It was so. I lived in a, grew up in a very bourgeois, very, very legalistic family. My father was like a stickler for everything. And the idea that he had a brother who delivered money to the Cotton Club in Harlem was pretty surprising. And I wasn't really sure if I should believe him. But later in the visit, I went out with Sarah and this my cousin's ex-wife, and they confirmed all these details, and in fact, were very proud of the story. And so that was my first piece of Kipnis lore, that we had this uncle who had worked for a gangster.
It's a great story.
Yes, I was quite floored.
So he was kind of a bag man for Dutch Schultz, if you really want to put it in the local
parlance.
Well,
I guess that's right. I mean, and what I was going to say is that there's a wonderful novel by Doctorow called Billy Bathgate.
Yeah,
it's great. Kind of traces the history of this boy who worked for Schultz, and it was actually very helpful to me, because I began to see, you know, how it could have happened that my uncle would have been, you know, involved in this.
Oh, for sure. So you also had a relative, as you continued to trace your history, who had perhaps a little more illustrious beginning, became a mayor.
Well, guess what? It's the same person.
Isn't that funny?
So in 1934, in the summer of 1934, or somewhere thereabouts, Sam moved to Arizona, and the reason was supposedly, and I think it's true, that his son Julian, my first cousin, had asthma, and he was actually quite ill. So Sam and his wife and this child moved to Tucson, and according to I have a second cousin by marriage who lives in Tucson, Brownie Ebner, and she reckons that he came from the east with money that was that the gang, that Dutch Schultz had given him,
kind of a
set
stake.
Up a stake,
right?
In since that was, it was right after repeal, in other words, I mean shortly after repeal. So he came and he bought a cafe called the Shamrock, very Jewish name, and it was a tiny little postage stamp town. I mean, I think it was like a mile long. I mean, he and four other property owners gathered together and petitioned to create and to incorporate South Tucson as an entity. And that led to his being elected to be, and I have this clipping, which is now in the archive, that says, Kipnis elected mayor of South Tucson. So that actually turned out to be an incredible, importantly, a very important piece of information, because it led to an archive. Because he was part of this movement that went on for decades, by the way, because Tucson, the city was not happy. They really wanted to annex this little tiny part of town. And so the struggle actually went back and forth for several decades. But that was his original claim to fame. He became a local celebrity. It was written up in the Arizona Star. And I really got a sense for the first time of what the personality was of this person, whom, as I think I said, I never met.
He must have really been a character.
I think so.
And of course, I should note that it's his Brownie. That's his daughter, right?
Brownie is his. I'll see. Oh, let me get this genealogy straight. Brownie is his niece
his
by
niece.
Marriage.
Okay. Well, it is a complicated genealogy. I'm looking at it, and I'm still not getting it right. So, you know, as you continued on this process, you know, you didn't just stop with the colorful figures. You really traced out the whole history of the family and the experience. You hadn't really, obviously, you're an academic, you're a trained researcher, but this hadn't been an interest of yours to a degree before, had it?
It's true. I mean, I was dimly aware that I didn't know anything about my father's side of the family, because the maternal family was huge and invasive and engulfing. And if I ever did ask my father anything, he either fell silent, or one time, this turned out to be kind of important for the book, I once asked him a story about growing up on the Lower East Side, and he started to tell the story, and his eyes welled up. He was a bit sentimental. But my mother interrupted him, and I never got the story. And it was kind of like there was some blockage about telling the story. So once the phone call came and I began to look, I saw that there are other ways to go. I mean, and the most important, there were so very many little clues, but what started to fascinate me was a photograph of my grandparents and Sam, the same Sam, who was an immigrant, a picture taken at a studio in Chisinev, which is now called Chisinau. It's now the capital of Moldova, but right. At the time it was just Chisinev in Bessarabia.
And you talk about the Chisinev pogroms and how they were sort of the Holocaust for Eastern European Jews until the Holocaust.
Yes, and I'm happy you brought up the pogrom word, because what I've found when I give talks on the book, or I see my book described, it's very often people assume, and maybe you found this on the show, that if you say Jewish, they think Holocaust. It's very hard to get people to think back to this incredibly important wave of immigration that went on, that there were 2 million Jews who emigrated between 1880 and 1924, when the Exclusion Act was published, was decreed, all those people, all those immigrants, you know, now end up with someone like me, my third generation, trying to reconstruct the history that they didn't tell. And so, but the fact that I had this photograph, that's why Sam played an important role, because I could more or less judge his age, and according to what he looked like, this picture had to be taken around 1903. They didn't leave until 1906. And the area of the pogrom was so small, the pogrom was so important, that there's no way that these people did not see the pogrom. I mean, that's
right.
That I'm convinced of. And I also did a huge amount of research on the pogrom, because it is the first pogrom that was photographed, and it was also internationally reported. And there's also a famous Hebrew poem written about it. So that I began to sort of attach myself to a kind of a history of an entire generation of people, and with a certain experience that I had absolutely seen as something very, very, very remote. And suddenly it seemed close. And that, I think, was part of the biggest surprise of the book, and how close I felt to the immigration experience and to this particular history.
You know, you tell or retell the famous Baal Shem Tov story about, you know, the Baal Shem Tov used to go to a particular place when trouble threatened the Jews and pray to God in a particular forest at a particular time, and it works its way through the generations. Tell a little bit about how that story affected you.
Well, one of the things that I struggled with doing the research was, you know, what my relationship to Jewishness was. In a way, it was, I had not, as long as my parents were alive, as long as my father was alive, it kind of was something that I took for granted and I didn't know very much about. But then as I learned the history, I became very attached, you know, to it. And the when I found out that my great-grandfather and my grandfather had actually been born in Bratislav, I became aware of this Hasidic writer, Nachman of Bratislav, and who was a very famous storyteller. And so in the process of doing that research, I came across the Baal Shem story about what happens to, I mean, the way I understood it, I mean, the way it seems to circulate is that there's a generation that believes in the prayers, says them, they go into the woods, they go to pray. And then there's a second generation that just kind of performs that experience without actually going into the woods. And then there's the next generation that retells the story, and they don't do any of the rituals. And that, I think, is what, that story felt very powerful to me, because what I came to feel was that I felt that I wanted to tell this story, not just because it was my story, and then I'm an autobiographer, but because I realized that it was really the story of a generation, a sort of post-pogrom, post-assimilation. There was nothing left to assimilate, it was really about a return to stories that had been lost and experiences that had been lost. And so any time I could find a trace of the previous generations, especially if I could find something in writing, which I did, it was very moving to me and very, I had a sense of renewal, even though I was so, you know, buried, not, I wasn't buried, but I mean, I was so involved with the past that, and with dead people and people I hadn't met and people I felt very sad that I hadn't met because some of them I could have met. But then I had a sense for myself of a kind of reconnection with a history and lost memories. And so that's why that story, that's how I interpret the story in any event, you know, that there is a kind of retrieval possible, a kind of return possible through this excavation of stories.
Well, it's a great story, and obviously we advocate that return here on Too Jewish. The book is called What They Saved, Pieces of a Jewish Past by Nancy K. Miller. It's a great piece of research, but it's also a great read, and I encourage you to look it up. Nancy, thanks for a great visit here.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Josh Kuhn, author, academic, and co-founder of the Edelson Society for Musical Preservation, which has recently released some extraordinary CDs of Jewish music from the 60s, including Songs for the Jewish American Jet Set and Black Sabbath. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from Joe Amar, the Moroccan-Israeli singing star who introduced Sephardic music to the Ashkenazi world. It's his version of the Song of Songs verse, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine, from one of the Edelson Society's recent re-releases. Next week you can hear more. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Shoshanim, Bashoshanim. Bye.